Hi, I'm Patrick McEnroe, and this is Holding Court.
Thanks to Raya Eyewear for sponsoring this episode of Holding Court. I've been wearing Raya since last year. During the pandemic, I started teaching more lessons than ever before, especially outside. Raya are by far the best sunglasses for tennis I've ever used. Check them out at RayaEyewear.com. That's R-I-A Eyewear.com and use the code Patrick to get $20 off your first pair. They are total game changers.
All right, time for another edition of Holding Court, everyone. And this man doesn't need too much introduction, and I don't even need to ask him any questions because he could go on for as long as he wants about any topic that we will discuss. Mr. Andy Roddick, welcome to Holding Court. And I've been waiting a long time to get you on. It's great to finally have you.
Captain, it's good to talk to you. All you had to do was ask, man.
Well, busy schedules. You know, I got three kids. You got a couple of younger ones, so that takes up a little bit of time. First things first, though, is what, and this is how I've conducted many of these podcasts with ex, you know, great champions like yourself, is to talk to me a little bit about your start in tennis. I mean, I know obviously about your brother who was a great junior player and college player, so it was sort of in the family a bit. But talk to me and to the listeners a little bit about how Andy Roddick got started in tennis. What are your first memories?
I think you have a brother who played tennis too. You know, if you're kind of around something enough, you don't know that, like, that one moment where you picked it up. But I had an older brother who was always playing. And so, you know, I don't know if it started on a backboard at Caswell Tennis Center or, you know, all of a sudden I had a lesson in time somewhere with, I think my first guy was Steve Jones in Austin, Texas. So I don't remember the first time. I just remember it kind of being in orbit from as long as I can remember. And so, you know, when you're younger, you think your older brothers are the coolest, and you kind of gravitate to what they're into. And when my mom was kind of, you know, driving around all day from this practice to that practice, you pick up on what's going on around you. So it kind of happened somehow, some way that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the same thing. In fact, I was doing a interview for a documentary that they're doing on that brother, the older brother of mine. I have two brothers. So do you, by the way. And I remember, you know, they actually interviewed me at the club where we grew up and where I learned how to play hitting against the wall. Yeah, and I wanted to do the same thing that you did, whatever my brothers did. So if that meant baseball, it was baseball. It just happened that we were a little bit better at tennis. And obviously you were into other sports. There's a, you know, fun story about you and Marty Fish playing basketball together at Boca Prep when you guys were kids. But tennis, why do you think you gravitated to tennis? I mean, for me and for us, it was, I think we were just better at tennis than the other sports. We were decent at the other sports. But as you started to be competitive and play junior tennis, what was the thing that made you want to stick with that individual sport?
Probably not dissimilar. I mean, you know, kids, not too different than adults, that you like to do what you're good at. But, you know, my parents also kind of, they thought team sports and individual sports both taught different lessons, none more important, but all of which maybe had value in different ways. You know, the biggest lesson of being good for life, then that you always have to have. So, you know, I remember playing soccer. And at 9 years old, you're young, but you realize that you're winning tournaments in the city that are 16-month tournaments. I'm going, okay, well, yeah, this is fun. I like this.
Yeah, and obviously you get good at it. And your first memories, Andy, of playing junior tennis, because obviously, I mean, we know about you know, the journey that is, and the perils that go along with junior tennis, and traveling around or playing the local, you know, whatever you need to do to get your ranking up, and that kind of pressure. But what was that like for you? And obviously having your older brother probably helped, because you were, like you said, you were around it. But what were most of your memories about of playing competitive junior tennis?
Well, honestly, I just remember the fun, like, around the tournament. It was like, you know, I was always kind of the younger kid playing up in divisions. And so, you know, even just hotel tag and, like, having this kind of general infrastructure of from a social aspect, but from kids at all around, like, the state. At that time, it was Texas. That was cool to me. You know, kind of obviously dealing with a ranking system for the first time where, you know, there was an actual goal and, you know, kind of each progression, then you go to state tournaments and then it grows. And each progression maybe is a little less innocent. You know, the parents are maybe a little more serious and then, you know, the consequences are maybe a little bit higher. Mm-hmm. You know, so as you grow and then all of a sudden you're, you know, on a trip by yourself, you know, staying at a Salvation Army in Hong Kong, trying to pick up junior tennis points. You know, so it's just crazy how it seems like such a long time, but in reality, that's, you know, a 6 or 7 year run where life is completely different and you're playing kind of the snowball open in Austin, and then all of a sudden you're sleeping on a cot somewhere, you know, in a world that you don't know. So it goes pretty quick.
So I tell this story, and I'm probably wrong about it. I mean, I tell quite a few of your stories, some of which I can't repeat even on a podcast. But the one of the ones I loved, especially now that I've gotten into actual teaching kids, which even my years with the USTA, you know, that was more political and more administrative. So I wasn't maybe on the court as much as I would have liked to be. But now having working here at our academy in New York, I'm actually on the court with a lot of kids, which has been a lot of fun working with coaches and actually being on the court with kids. So I find, Andy, that teaching the serve is maybe the most difficult thing. So I tell your story of how, you know, your serve became this unbelievable weapon, and it happened sort of on a fluke, right? When you were pissed off that you were having trouble with your serve, yeah, and then you found this motion. How old were you exactly, and how did that take place?
I was probably 15, and it wasn't even just pissed off about my server. It was kind of pissed off about my general tennis ability. But I was playing with Marty, and, you know, at that time, he had a lot of momentum, and he had gone from where we were probably pretty similar players, and then all of a sudden, he made a move and was one of the best juniors in the world, and I wasn't quite that. And so there was probably a healthy jealousy in play, and he was doing what he did most days then and just was kind of tuning me up a little bit in practice. His talent was very apparent. It wasn't something I felt like I was on par with. And so I just kind of reared back, hit up two, and just, you know, hit the ball as hard as I could. As part of the first iteration of the motion that people might know now. But it went in, and then I did it again the next one, and it went in, and then all of a sudden the talent bud, what didn't seem like it was this far.
This episode is being brought to you by Raya Eyewear. Over the last few years, a growing concern of mine has been the long-term effects of overexposure to UV rays from my extended time on court in the sun, you know, following that little yellow ball all over the globe. Well, I was also just tired of squinting on sunny days, but my fear was always that wearing sunglasses to protect my eyes would affect the way I hit the ball. Well, last year, especially during the pandemic last summer, I came across Raya, and I'm so, so glad that I did. Raya is changing the way tennis players see the game and protect their most important performance asset, their vision. All of their eyewear is handcrafted in Italy and built specifically to enhance ball contrast and provide protection from those harmful UV rays. There's no question that they help me see the ball better, they relax my eyes in the sun, and they've become an essential part of my tennis experience. Check them out at RiaEyewear.com. That's RiaEyewear.com. Use the code Patrick to get $20 off your first pair. I promise you will love these sunglasses.
And so you kind of went to that like half motion or just a straight up motion just because you're just trying to find a way to get more pop?
I honestly think it was frustration. And I thank God, because had I missed that the first couple, I don't know that I would have stuck with it. But it went in, there was a pop to it.
Right.
It was simple. It was something that I could repeat over and over. You know, I certainly got tight on the court. It rarely happened around the serve. You know, so being able to kind of, and as you know, and as a teacher, the biggest thing I see, a lot of people that are so obsessed with technical aspects, And for me, you certainly want to adjust technique and you want to make it as good as it can get. But, you know, there are people who hit a really ugly ball but can repeat it over and over and over. And there are some people who play really pretty and have perfect technique, but there's breakdown of some sort when pressure enters. So that might not be the way to go about it, even though it looks great. And so with my serve, obviously, it's weird looking, but I can repeat it.
Well, one of the great things you said to me when we were just starting out is I was the Davis Cup captain and you were our stalwart for so many years, was you said, whatever you do, captain, never say a word to me about my serve. You remember that? You said you could say anything. You always like to test me if I was paying attention, you know, like, did you see, well, you know, if this guy missed that backhand up the line, I could go there. But I remember very clearly you said, whatever you do, don't say a freaking word to me about my serve. I said, got it. I got it, Andy. Okay, no problem.
Yeah, I get that story back to me from a lot of people that coached me. It was the thing that I felt like I had kind of complete control over. Even on my off days, it was still pretty serviceable. I knew the feelings of my serve, but they were like, they didn't really make much sense when you tried to articulate them. So if we're talking about direction of serve, or if we're talking about that's fine, but let's never get into the technical aspect of my serve. It's a few things about my tennis game that I felt I 100% knew more about than whoever was trying to analyze it.
All right, so let's look just at your career and his amazing career, top 10 for 9 straight years, which I know you're very proud of because you were so consistent and your work ethic was phenomenal. Obviously, you win the major at the U.S. Open, but when you look back. Now that you've been retired for a few years and you started your own businesses and doing things outside of tennis, what matches, what are you most proud of when you look back now that you've had some distance between your career and what you were able to accomplish?
Wins come and go. You can look back and trophies are cool. I like the memories. I like to think that even if, and I certainly had I'm sure you can attest to this, I have a personality that was, I think you knew what you were going to get. I was consistent, but I wasn't always easy. But even with people who I may or may not have had disagreements with, maybe there's arguments on court, people that even I might not have gotten along with, I still feel like the base level of respect for the way that I went about it. And so that I'm very proud of. The matches, I obviously think of our Davis Cup ties. That's a huge deal to me. It's a little heartbreaking for me to see kind of where it is currently. Maybe even more heartbreaking if I try to project forward and see where it's going. So that's certainly disappointing. Playing in all the places that you dream of. I played 40 some odd times on Arthur Ashe Stadium court, a lot at night. Kind of took the mantle of playing those night matches and the Wimbledon finals and that Wimbledon final. They all kind of run together, and it's just this amazing life that seems so far away now. It's certainly I know I retired young, but part of me is very happy that I did that because I look back so fondly. I was always excited to get up and go to work. And I know a very small portion of people are able to say that about a career or a former career.
Yeah, it seems like, and I remember that as vividly as yesterday when you sort of announced during that U.S. Open it was going to be your last one. You had a great final match with Del Potro, who I know you respected a lot. It was a great, not only a great player, but a great person. So to go out the way you did. But I think some of us were a little surprised because I think we knew that you could play longer if you wanted to. Maybe you weren't going to be at the very, very top, but you certainly were going to be right, in the mix for a number of years to come. But you always were very true to yourself, I think. And you felt like, as you just sort of intimated there, that the desire, maybe you felt it waning a little bit and that you thought that was the time to do it. So you don't have any regrets, obviously, about making the, because you see some of your, I mean, most of your contemporaries are done. Hewitt, the Saffins, the Ferrero, who you beat in the U.S. Open final. But obviously you still got Roger there, but he's a freak of nature. We know that. But most of the guys you played against also retired, but it seems like you really, really went out on your own terms.
Yeah, it was some combination of all that. I knew that I always wanted to retire at the U.S. Open. So at that point, it was like, do I want to go through another year? My body was starting to struggle, not so much with the playing, but with the training, which is what I felt that I had to do to compete with the guys who were frankly just better than I was. You know, I was trying to get better than them on a given day and try to catch lightning in a bottle and make a run and win that. Felt like more and more of a distant possibility with the way that I needed to go about things. It's just been feeling like I was worked for the first time. I won two out of my last four events on tour, so I knew I could play a little, but I want to play a lot. And I've been possible at the five sets going through further over the course of 2 weeks. When that felt like something I was hoping for as opposed to something that I actually could happen, for me, that was it.
Well, I have to tell this one little, I mean, we have a lot of stories and we could go on for forever about them, but because when I talk to especially to kids now, and even to parents of young kids who are pretty good, but you know, they're not going to be a pro. And so you want to keep it in perspective for them. I say, you know, it's pretty easy to, not easy, but many players try their ass off when they're winning, right? Many players, even when it's close and they think they could win, they try their ass off. But there's very few players that I've come across over the years, and you're one of them, that tries their absolute ass off when they know that they're going to lose. And so that brings me, and there weren't that many times when you knew you were going to lose a match, but when you played Nadal in Davis Cup, and this wasn't not the first time when you actually could have won the match, but when you played him in Madrid in the semifinals, we were the U.S. against Spain, and you were playing your ass off, and you had no shot. I mean, because this was Nadal at his absolute greatest on clay, and you were two sets down, and you were down an early break in the third, and you were still, you know, doing everything you could to win a point. You came over, and you said, "Captain, what do I do?" And it was sort of like, you know, we kind of looked at each other. And what I respected about you and still do so much was that you knew that you were going to lose, but you were going to put 100% into it still at that point. And where do you think that quality came from? Because that's not something that even some of the all-time greats don't have that.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I might just be very simple. I remember that. I remember right before he went out, there was woke up in the morning. I think it was drizzling or rain. I don't know. And we finished warm up, and all of a sudden, there's like a closed circuit feed into our locker room, and some duck with a wheelbarrow and a shovel, and on that court shoveling more clay onto the court.
Right.
Someone had kicked me in the testicles that day, so I watched that. I'm watching that from the locker room. The most I yelled, kind of went up there and took my bidding. I was like, "Captain, you got a wheelbarrow away."
Yeah, got to do something about that extra clay. Yeah.
Yeah. So I remember us being in the locker room, there's like this light feed that we get, you know, where you can kind of see people hitting. It's kind of grainy, and they were out there with a wheelbarrow that was full of clay. Which I certainly didn't need at that moment in time.
Right.
And I remember yelling, "Get out there! Tell him to put that wheelbarrow away. It's illegal. I got an uphill battle as it is." But you know, as we fast forward to later that afternoon, and the surprise of no one being down two sets to Rafa on clay, and you know, you mentioned just kind of giving credit for effort. That was always a weird thing for me. You know, I'm not sure where it comes from. Maybe it's just simple. My dad was a farmer in Wisconsin, had a pretty tough childhood and kind of grinded and asked a lot of questions and kind of figured, life out on some scale. But, I always tell people, like, effort is a choice. You know, know, there are a lot of things in sports and life that aren't choices. You know, things can happen to you, things, you know, good and bad, but effort was always kind of like a conscious choice. You know, so that was always one of those non-negotiables, and it seems simple enough in theory. So in my mind, it should just kind of be simple in practice. It might not always work. It's certainly frustrating, but, you know, what's the option? What's the other option? It's like not trying. That didn't seem very good.
Yeah, no, and that was never an option that I saw you employ with your attitude. And as I said, your work ethic was second to none. So you had the opportunity, Andy, to play against, you know, the greatest players of all time in their prime. And in your prime as well. Obviously, you played Roger many times in huge major finals, a couple Wimbledons, U.S. Open. You played Djokovic when he was, you know, coming up, as you did with Nadal. But you talk about, I mean, I'm not going to ask you who was the greatest. I mean, they're all great, and obviously on different surfaces, it's a different story. But just the challenges that each of them faced, and what the, you know, the excitement level for you. Obviously, you had Murray as well, who was an all-time great, who you had some great wins against him. But as far as those three guys who have now distanced themselves from everyone, what was your mindset and what was your take on each of them?
Well, it's weird. Like, the greatest of all time, like, that conversation will play out. You know, we're in a rush to kind of be able to say that, you know, any name with confidence. You know, the way I see it is that Djokovic ties any of those guys with slams.
Mm-hmm.
The other metric he's firmly in control of, whether it's thousands, head-to-head, reaches number one. You know, so if he ties, it's actually tough to make a statistical argument against him. Then it just becomes who you like and whose style you like. And,
right.
You know, but the numbers are the only thing that are guaranteed. So we'll try to base it off that. But as far as specific challenges, like, it just becomes matchups, right? Like, I obviously had a horrendous record against Roger just because everything I did well kind of played into his pocket. And he had that little chip down to my back end, which he knew that I couldn't really hit topspin on. You know, as kind of a get out of jail free card, where I was forced to make a bad decision. I was either coming in on something that was average, or I was kind of restarting a point, neither of which was a good option for me. You know, and he was able to, he served so well. You know, was able to hold, was able to mix it up. I was an okay returner if people had very clear patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Then I could firm it up. I could, you know, get myself into the point on the second serve. Roger, to this day, like, if you said, oh, okay, you know, it's 30-40, where is he going? What's he doing? I still don't know. You know, so it was just hard. And then he could walk my serve back and get neutral off my first serve probably as well as anyone. And so it was just, the matchup was hard. The adjustments I had to make were hard. So I had to play a game that I wasn't comfortable with and executed to perfection to really get the result that I wanted against Roger. And when we did play, and when I was playing my best, it was always in a final, which means he was kind of in full flight as well. You know, with Rafa, it was obviously, it was probably the most surface dependent rivalry. You know, if we played on something really fast, and I remember playing him in Dubai one time. And, you know, if I was making my first serve, I was normally getting a ball that I could come out of my shoes on the second serve. And I was going to get looked at his second serve. And so it was probably the simplest game plan, not because of what he was doing. It's just that he did everything so well that it kind of narrowed the choices down to very few that of which you had to execute well. But you got to look at them a little bit more often. Obviously, on a slow surface, it was like, it was, you know, you mentioned the match in 08 in Davis Cup in the semis, and you'd go in trying to lie to yourself about what you might be able to do when, you know, I always think of Mr. T when he just says it's going to be painful.
right.
You know, and so, you know, that was more surface dependent. Fast service, I felt like I could get in the mix and you know, kind of played on my terms a little bit. Slow service, it was you know, a little bit of water torture where, you know, it might not feel bad all the time, but you're going to end up on the wrong side of it. And, you know, Novak is intriguing to me because he's kind of flipped a lot of the narrative from his early career. I mean, we see what he is now. And, you know, I remember, I look back at my notes. I'm like, okay, let's get the chip down to his forehand. Let's extend rallies. I didn't mean saying that to him.
Wow.
Let's extend rallies. Let's keep him out in the heat of the day. Let's try to, you know, make him breathe heavy. You know, let's see if we can kind of get in it to where, you know, he kind of fades away from the competition a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you could get him to do that. And now it's like you don't even recognize that guy anymore with what he's been able to do from a physical perspective. I remember watching that Aussie Open where he played those back-to-back five setters. I'm going, this doesn't even match with what kind of I knew. And I had some success against Novak. You know, in my career, you know, more than the other two guys. But I will say this. I remember, I think we played like an exhibition, and it was in South Korea. It was in Seoul. I think it was 2010. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one of those things where you get off the plane, you're using it as like a nice little soft landing, you get a sweat, you get a payday, and then you get onto the tournaments that you're going to play there. And so we had arrived, and I'm kind of dragging, and, you know, it's jet lag, and, you know, Dougie, who you know well, who are the sure. basic trainer, I was like, okay, let's get some cores, let's get a stretch. You know, the goal of the first day is, you know, to get a casual hit in, get a sweat, and, you know, not get hurt off the plane.
Right.
And so we get there like an hour before, which, you know, was a lot. You know, and Novak was out on the court doing all these weird, you know, things, movements I had never seen before. This guy stretching him. Going through his paces, I'm like, well, I thought I was the professional here, and I look like a chump compared to what this guy's doing and how committed he is. That was very eye opening to me because I wasn't privy to kind of his day to day operation.
Mm-hmm.
You just show up, play him, and you know, you kind of see what you see. I'm going, oh, okay, well, that doesn't really align with what I see on court sometimes. And he came out and drilled me in like an hour. I'm going, oh, that was different. and then the last two matches I played against him, it was a different level of tennis. There was nowhere to hurt him. He wasn't giving you the tight double fault at Deuce and the flag forehand at 30-40 potentially. And then a look at him box with like a look of panic on his face. Those things were gone. And I'm going, oh no, this is kind of a different thing.
Right.
Anyway, 11, I think, was the first year he finished number one. And so, you know, I kind of got out of the game before he could reverse our head-to-head, and that certainly would have been reversed based on our last two matches. But I do remember 2012 at the Olympics. I had been hurt early in the year, so I wasn't seated. I think he had won Wimbledon, but we were supposed to play second round. And that was a big match on paper on grass. I had played well on grass in the past. And I was kind of pumped. I won Atlanta going into that event. So I was like, okay, I kind of found some form. I played well. I hit the ball cleanly, walked off the court feeling really good about my game. I lost 2-2. That was the first time.
Wow.
That was the first time I was like, this might be a different game than you're used to playing. And I don't know that lightning in a bottle will get it done for you at this level.
So 2-2, he beat you on grass.
On grass, and right. I didn't serve as well as I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as hitting the ball, I walked off. I felt really good, and there was just nowhere to go. There was nowhere to beat him. High, low, short, long, through. Those were all bad options, and so that was confusing at best.
It's amazing to hear you talk about it because it's you realized what the – I mean, you always knew it about Nadal. I mean, he's 17, 18. He's dominating already on clay, starting to dominate. Yeah. Roger is Roger just with his talent and his ability. But it's like the Djokovic has had the most amazing transformation because, like you said, he was a little soft. I mean, soft is too strong a word, but he was suspect mentally and physically early on. And now you know, when you watch him, you're right. I mean, especially when you talk about Roger getting to the finals of Wimbledon, of course, that's when he plays his best. And now it's Novak, you know, just like this year's Australian Open. It's like, okay, now he's locked in. You know, the last two, three matches, I mean, there's just, as you said, nowhere to go. Well, we're going to see how it plays out for those guys the next, the next couple of years. You think Roger's got one more shot left in him? I mean, one more shot at Wimbledon? What do you think?
I mean, he's got a shot always. You know, probably for the first time in my life, I know I kind of laugh about it. I remember in 2013, all the questions about Roger, and he's had a back injury. He's like, this is it. I'm like, no, it's just health. he gets healthy, he's going to be the same guy. Like, he's, nothing's changed. The fact that it, you know, so let's hope he gets rehab. But it's going to be really hard now. You know, unlike the times before when he's been hurt, he wasn't the best player in the game before he left for this last year.
Right.
You know, he was kind of at the point where he was hoping to catch, you know, 2 weeks of hot, and then, you know, he almost pulled it out against Novak at Wimbledon. I think that's probably going to be the first match in his career where he actually lived through some scar tissue for a long time. You know, he's so amazing at kind of water off a duck's ass, on with the next one, great attitude. I feel like that was probably the first one that stuck with him, you know, so the rest of us feel like we're miserable for weeks at a time afterwards. So, yeah, you add that in, and it's like, okay, two knee surgeries. Is that going to make it better? Is that going to change the scenario for the better for him? And I don't see how it does. I will never be surprised by anything Roger Federer does on a tennis court. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know that I would bet on it at this point.
Right. All right, so Andy Roddick, post-tennis, I mean, you've done a lot of cool things, including being on an all-sport show, which is something I always wanted to do, and you jumped in and you did an awesome job on Fox for as long as that show lasted. You did your own radio show as well with a good buddy of yours for a while. Obviously, you're great on your tennis stuff with Tennis Channel, BBC you've worked for as well. And I know your foundation, which you started years ago, the Andy Roddick Foundation. And by the way, please go to that online and help out Andy's great foundation down in Texas, which helps so many kids, particularly with everything that's happened in the country and in Texas specifically in the last year. So I know your crew's done a hell of a job helping people. But what's been for you? Obviously, you got a young family, you got a great wife. For you post tennis, what's been the most satisfying? I know you've got some business ventures and interests that you're heavily involved in too. What's been the most, you know, joyful for you post career in tennis?
I mean, obviously the foundation is kind of the tentpole of all of it. And, you know, to see where we're at the point now where we serve, you know, tens of thousands of kids a day in Central Texas is, not something that I thought would have been a possibility when it was just you know, kind of a simple idea and mixed with a little bit of good intent. But yeah, I mean, the business side has been fascinating because it's a weird thing, and I think you know, a fault of a lot of ours is to think you're an expert at one thing, therefore you're an expert at everything, and kind of learning that is not the truth. But it's been fun trying to gain new information, going into different things, you know, from real estate to retail to, you know, bourbon to healthcare to tech. It's just been such an enlightening journey to kind of tag along with some amazing, you know, founders and entrepreneurs and kind of see, you know, when you see a brand grow from something small and then all of a sudden it, you know, either goes public or at least has a sizable market share. And it's all just been a ton of fun, and unlike the sport that we love, it largely doesn't have to control your geography.
So right.
That's been that's probably been the best part of it is just, you know, you react to someone else's schedule for such a long time, and now to be able to you know, where your road trips are 2 days at a time as opposed to 2 months at a time, that's been something that has been very calming. In my life, it's given me the chance to make very selfish decisions, but in a good way, kind of prioritize time with family as opposed to trying to kind of fit it in, you know, kind of outside of our tennis circus. So it's been a blast. I've really enjoyed it. You know, tennis has given me everything I have, and it's controlled nothing of what I do post career. So it's been great, and I know I'm kind of the weird one who, you know, doesn't really go to many events, and you know, probably the only positive personally from this whole pandemic is that there was proof of concept whether let me sit in front of a computer or an iPad and talk tennis on air. So that's been amazing for me. It's been you know, it's like falling in love all over again. So that's been great. Post career has definitely looked a lot different than the decade and a half that preceded it.
Yeah, well, you know what? You're not even 40 yet, so you've already done amazing stuff since you left tennis. And I know that, you know, from a personal standpoint, Andy, every day I walk into our tennis academy and I got a poster up of us holding that Davis Cup. It was certainly the greatest moment for me in my professional life. And the one person who I have to thank more than anyone, and of course the Bryan brothers and Marty Fish and James Blake and Robbie Ginepri and all the people that played their part, but nobody played the part like you did. You were the true leader. In many ways, I look to you oftentimes for guidance, you know, on some of the other players, and we butted heads at different times, which was all good, because you know you were straightforward, and I always respected that. And I just want to say here, thank you for all you did for me, not only from a professional standpoint, but personally as well.
Yeah, I mean, we shared great memories. I think when we started, I think we were both probably, you know, you were a new captain. It always seemed like you knew what you were doing. I don't know if it felt that way.
Definitely not.
I definitely didn't feel like I knew what I was doing as a player. And, as all great relationships, you know, they kind of go on. I was a kid when we started, and you took a chance on me, and there was a certain dynamic. And then away from Davis Cup, I became a little bit more established, where it was a partnership. And, we certainly always both cared, and we didn't, you know, agree all the time, which you're not supposed to. But I hope that you would think that there was always an underlying lesson. I know at the end of the day, and I did call you. I called you in a panic before the 08 U.S. Open. I was like, listen, my coaching situation is not going to work. Can you kind of drop everything and just pay attention to me for the next 2 weeks? And you did that. And I hope, you would know that it would go the other way as well. The memories are just phenomenal. Even, the little things inside the locker room and the jokes and everything that came out of it, those were certainly some of the best years. And, unfortunately for that competition that we love, I don't know that they were those memories are going to be recreated in locker rooms across the world much longer.
Yeah, it doesn't look good for Davis Cup in the future, but it looks good for Andy Roddick in the future. And you stay in touch. And like you said, you always had the back of your teammates. You were their leader, and they knew that. And even when we were setting this up, I remember I texted you, or we were talking about some other political stuff about the tennis world, which we'll get into another time. And you called me right away because you thought, oh, something's up. What's up with Patrick? He sent me a quick text. And, you immediately thought maybe something was wrong. So that tells me a lot about what you think about me. I appreciate it. Good luck with everything you're doing. And hopefully we will see each other as hopefully we're nearing the end of this crazy year we've all had.
Yeah, thanks, Captain. Now, give my love to your girls, please.
All right, you too. Andy Roddick here on Holding Court.
Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe is powered by Mudhouse Media.